Good morning and welcome. My name is Lou Feldstein, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, and with today's first speaker of the season, Dr. Robert Putnam. First, though, please join me in thanking our musician today, Jose Lozano.
Thank you. Sir.
Okay. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. And we especially want to thank the Reading Foundation for sponsoring Dr. Putnam's talk today. So our speaker today, as I mentioned before, and my long-term mentor and friend is Robert Putnam, professor of public policy at Harvard University. Bob was dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard, and he was a past president of the American Political Science Association. And among his numerous scholarly honors have been the Skype Prize, the most prestigious global award in political science, and the National Humanities Medal, which is this nation's highest honor in the humanities. And with Ken Burns, Bob is the only living New Hampshire recipient of the Humanities Medal. He's written 14 books, two of them, Bowling Alone and Making Democracy Work, have both been among the most cited publications in the social sciences in the last half century. Bob has consulted for the last three American presidents, the last three British prime ministers, the French president, premiers and prime ministers from Ireland to Singapore and Europe and Asia. And today, Bob will be speaking to us. We're going to find out that this is the 142nd talk Bob has given in the 1 year, in a little more than 1 year, since the book has been published. Now, that's significant. And it is significant. There are some other measures of significance before I actually introduce to Bob. First of all, Bob, as many of you know, has shown the great good sense to make his home here in the Monadnock region. Great judgment. Even more telling is beyond Bob's success as a world figure and as a great scholar has been the rankings that Bob has received from his students at Harvard. Now, some of you are smiling and saying, come on. World presidents, prime ministers versus ranking by students. But students are tough. They can be difficult. Don't laugh. I'm not laughing at this. This is real stuff. And significantly, Bob's courses have ranked among the highest and most popular in Harvard year after year after year. And this tells you something. Sure, Bob is brilliant. Sure, Bob writes great stuff. Sure, Bob commands the attention of world leaders. But also, and maybe the most telling thing about Bob is Bob as a teacher. And that's the experience that most of us have had. Bob has been willing over the years to, as the economist says it, to tell his story in language that is modest, with an understated tone. He has been willing to go again and again into the public, to all kinds of groups, large and small, from very different backgrounds, to talk directly about his work, to take the risk of questions, of challenges, of criticism. And I believe that those qualities are the same qualities that have made Bob so effective as a teacher at many dimensions and as a world leader. And so, as Bob now turns to his latest book, Our Kids, for his 143rd speech, you get to play the role as students, but also as listeners and critiques. So I introduce you to Dr. Robert Putnam.
Wow, thanks very much for those kind introductory remarks, Lou. I feel truth in advertising requires me to say that although it's true that my courses are highly rated, what you also need to know is that my wife and I live very close to the Harvard campus, and I teach this course in my living room, And it's a small class, and it's just like the 1950s. We have a tea break, and my wife, Rosemary, sitting right there, bakes fresh-baked cookies each week for the class. And so if you go to the Harvard public, this is publicly available, the Harvard Q Guide, and ask and look up to see what they say about me, they're mostly not talking about me. They're mostly talking about Rosemary's cookies. That's the honest answer. It's terrific to be back here. I really enjoy speaking in this context, and I know there are many friends. I have many friends here in this room. I'm going to be talking today about a problem that I think is the most serious domestic problem that America faces. And I'm going to be telling you some stories and sharing with you some observations that are pretty depressing, actually. I'm going to be talking about a growing gap in this country between what I will loosely call rich kids and poor kids. And therefore, much of the things that I want to say to you this morning are pretty depressing, actually. And so I want to warn you that at least the first part of the talk is pretty depressing. But I also am pretty optimistic that we can fix this problem. And that we can fix this problem actually right here in the Mananic region and in New Hampshire. So at the end, in the last part of my talk, I'm going to take this optimistic turn and talk about what you can do to help our country fix this problem. So I want to begin by, at the 30,000-foot level, talking about what's been happening in America over the last half century or so. A lot of good things have happened in America since the 1950s and 1960s and 1970s. A lot of good things have happened. To begin with, we've made significant progress on overcoming gender inequalities in America. The opportunities that are available to my daughter and my granddaughters are much greater than the opportunities that were available to the young women that I went to high school with in the 1950s. We've made some progress, not enough. Everybody in this room knows not enough, but we've made some progress in addressing our longstanding racial injustices in this country. We have niftier telephones than we did. But in one important way, our country has gone very much in the wrong direction over the last 50 years. Things have gotten a lot worse in one pretty fundamental way, and that is class divisions, divisions of America and American communities along lines of income and education have gotten much greater and much deeper in a way that I believe threatens the very idea, the very fundamental norms in America, that basically everybody ought to have a decent chance to get ahead. And you can see this class division in lots of different ways. One of them is, of course, we know, we've been listening through the campaign debate over the last year or so, a growing income gap in America between, roughly speaking, affluent folks and poor folks. If you line up all of Americans along the front of this room here, from the most affluent over here on the far right of this room, this is going to be the rich end of the room for present purposes, down to that end, and I'm sorry, that's going to be the impoverished end of America, and with homeless people over there against the wall, and Bill Gates is sitting up here on my right-hand side. What's happened over the last 30 or 40 years is that the folks over there have had a really good run. So their incomes have risen very sharply. But folks from about the middle, the median income, on down to the bottom, haven't had a raise in the last 30 or 40 years. So that's one way in which we've become a much more divided society in class terms. Actually, that's probably not the most important way in which we've become more divided. Another way in which we've become divided, much less discussed, but quite fundamental, is that we have become more segregated in class lines. Where we live much more now depends upon our income and education than it used to. Increasingly, rich folks are living in enclaves only with other rich folks, and poor folks are living in enclaves only with other poor folks, and fewer of us are living in mixed or moderate income neighborhoods. And that has powerful implications for the rest of our lives. For example, it affects powerfully who our kids go to school with. So increasingly, affluent kids are going to school only with other affluent kids, and impoverished kids, and remember, I don't mean just, you know, the homeless kids. I'm talking about what we used to call the working class. Working class kids in America are increasingly going to school only with other working class kids. And fewer schools and classrooms in America have people from the other side of the tracks. Whichever side of the tracks your child is on, it's very likely now that there are only kids from that side of the tracks in the classroom. And since a very important thing, maybe the most important thing about any school is who else is going there, increasingly, kids from affluent homes are concentrated in high-income schools with all sorts of advantages, and kids from, you know, working-class homes are increasingly concentrated in low-income schools only with other working-class kids. That affects not just the amount of resources that are available, because when these kids, these affluent kids go to school, in their backpack, they bring their parents' aspirations and their parents' trips to Paris and their and all of the other things that are happening, and those are helping all the other kids there, but those other kids are also now increasingly affluent. And when poor kids go to school, they bring in their backpack drug or substance abuse from their home. They bring that into the classroom. I don't mean that they personally are druggies. I mean that the effects of that are coming into the classroom, and then they bring in gang violence, and those things disrupt everybody's education. So this segregation, first of all in terms of where we live, but and secondly in terms of where our schools, our kids go to school, that's a powerful factor. And what's even more important is that increasingly whom we marry depends upon, you know, our own economic background. Increasingly those folks marry only other folks from that section of society, and those folks on the poor side are increasingly marrying only people from poor backgrounds. Whom we marry is an important subtle sociological indicator of how our country fits together, fundamentally because we tend not to marry people whom we've not met. Thank you. That was a joke. I didn't know whether the jokes were allowed in this context. What I mean by that is that when intermarriage rates rise across some boundary, like, for example, interfaith marriages are much more common now than they used to be, and that reflects the fact that people in their marriageable years are just encountering people from different religious backgrounds more now than they used to, and sometimes sparks fly. And conversely, the fact that interclass marriages are declining, sharply declining, is a silent but powerful indicator of the fact that we only ever encounter in our daily lives people who have the same kind of background as we have. And a third big change is that the family and community ties that used to be so strong in the working class in America have now begun to crumble, partly as a result of the economic hard times that they faced. So, for example, there is a growing gap between the kids in the affluent side of town and the kids in the impoverished side of town in the number of parents they have. I mean, the number of parents with whom they're living. There has been virtually no change in the incidence of single-parent families among affluent Americans. It used to be single parents were about, kids living in single parent homes in affluent America was about 5%. That's now risen to 7%. It used to be that kids living in the working class, about 15% of them were single parents, and now that's almost 70%. Of all kids growing up in working class homes in America, of all races, are living in single parent homes. And I want to be careful. I'm not saying that that's a moral problem. That's not what I'm worried about. I'm not blaming it on the moms. If I were going to blame it on anybody, I'd blame it on the absent dads. But what I am saying is all the evidence shows it's just harder to raise kids if there's only one parent in the house. And that means, among other things, this big change means that these kids have, from day one in their lives, some important advantages in terms of people caring for them, numbers of people caring for them, and the amount of love they're surrounded by and so on, than the kids in the working class were increasingly growing up in fragile and fractured families. Now, the sum of all these changes that I've tried to describe at 30,000 feet, what's been happening in America, now I want to talk about the implications of all those things for kids. Because what I will want to argue to you is that the summation of all these trends I've talked about is a growing opportunity gap. The odds that a kid will do well in life, the difference between the odds that kids in affluent homes are going to do well in life and the odds that kids from modest backgrounds will do well in life, that gap between those two classes has grown enormously. It's what I call an opportunity gap. And that has powerful, powerful implications for the future of our country. Now, those of you who've heard me talk before or who read my books will know that I'm basically a numbers person. So there's always a lot of graphs and charts in my books, and I will be talking about some numbers here in a minute. But I want to begin this this part of the description of what's happening to kids in America today with a story. It's a story about a small town in the middle of America. It's called Port Clinton, Ohio. Port Clinton's a small town on Lake Erie in Ohio. It's just about the same size as Peterborough. And I'm going to begin the story in the 1950s, and I know Port Clinton in the 1950s pretty well because it's my hometown. So I just want to tell you a little bit about my hometown. I promise I won't inflict this, I wouldn't inflict this on you if it weren't the case that I think it has implications that Port Clinton turns out to be typical of America as a whole. So when I grew up in Port Clinton in the 1950s, it was like Lake Wobegon on Lake Erie. Nobody very rich, nobody very poor, pretty modest place. Of my high school graduating classmates, the Port Clinton High School graduating class of 1959, almost half of us were the first in our family to graduate from high school, so a very modest place. And no, we weren't really not very conscious of class differences in those years. Now, it's a long time ago. More than 50 years ago. All of my classmates are 75, as am I. And we know how well we've done. And we have done amazingly well. 80% of us in the PCH class of 1959 have done better than our parents. And what is even more astonishing is that the kids from the wrong side of the tracks in Port Clinton in the 1950s have done just about as well as the kids from the right side of the tracks. It was close to the American dream. That is, how well the class of 1959 in Port Clinton has depended overwhelmingly on our God-given talents and our hard work, and has depended almost not at all by what our parents did or didn't do. That's kind of a reasonable embodiment of the American dream. I do not mean Port Clinton was perfect in the 1950s. It certainly wasn't. There was racism in Port Clinton in the 1950s, and there was for sure gender imbalance. There was a glass ceiling that when the women in my graduating class got to college, they hit a glass ceiling, and that has changed. Of course, we know that's changed, but in terms of class was not a big deal. So I graduated from Port Clinton High School, got a fellowship from a local company, went off to college, met a really smart, attractive young, we called them co-eds in those days. She's sitting right there. And we've been hanging out together for more than the last, 55, 56 years. So far, so good. And Rosemary and I had two kids. They both graduated from Harvard, and they got graduate degrees and went on to distinguished professional careers, both of them. They both got married. They had, between them, seven kids. So we've got seven grandchildren. I want to show you the pictures of my seven grandchildren. All seven of our grandchildren either are now in one of America's finest institutions of higher education, or they're on their way there, or they have just recently graduated there. Our oldest granddaughter just graduated last month from a very distinguished college in Philadelphia. She majored in French literature. She spent not last summer, but the summer before last in Paris studying, or she told us she was studying French architecture and French cuisine. I'm sure about the French cuisine part of it. And her name is Miriam, and I'm very, very proud of Miriam. She's a terrific kid. She's worked hard. She's now got a regular job, and she's set. She's on a really good trajectory. Meanwhile, back in Port Clinton, there was another guy that was just a year or two behind me in graduating Port Clinton High School. I'm going to call him Joe. That's not his real name, but he's a real person. Joe graduated from Port Clinton High School, decided not to go to college, but went and got a working class job, did well for much of his life. His income was higher than my income. Joe got married. Joe had a couple of kids. Joe's kids graduated from Port Clinton High School, and they thought they'd have the same kind of satisfying life as their parents had had. And then the bottom fell out, and the factories all closed. The factories in town where many of my classmates' dads worked are all physically there, but they're ruins, surrounded by barbed wire fences and EPA signs. The fishing industry's gone because the Lake Erie became polluted. The local army base is closed. And Port Clinton now looks like a basket case. Think of the worst kind of video you've ever seen of a Rust Belt city. That's Port Clinton. And so Joe's kids have never held a steady job. But that has not stopped Joe's kids from having kids. I now want to read you just briefly from the life history of Joe's oldest granddaughter. I've told you about our oldest granddaughter, Miriam. I want to tell you about the woman we're going to call Mary Sue. Mary Sue is not a real name, but she is for sure a real person. And these are the field notes that my very capable colleague, Jen Silva, submitted to us after talking with Joe's granddaughter, whom we're going to call Mary Sue. So you have the basic picture. Mary Sue and Miriam are exactly the same age. Miriam is my granddaughter. Mary Sue is Joe's granddaughter. Mary Sue tells a harrowing tale of loneliness, distrust, and isolation. Her parents split up when she was 5, and her mother turned to stripping and left her alone and hungry for days. Her dad hooked up with a woman who hit her, refused to feed her, and confined her to her room with baby gates. Caught trafficking marijuana herself at 16, Mary Sue spent several months in a juvenile detention center, failed out of high school, and got a diploma online. Her experiences have left Mary Sue with a deep-seated mistrust of anyone and everyone, embodied in the scars on her arms, which we saw where a boyfriend had burned her in the middle of the night just before we met her. Mary Sue wistfully recalls her stillborn baby, born when she was 13. Since breaking up with the baby's dad, who left her for someone else, and with a second fiancé, who cheated on her after his release from prison, Mary Sue is currently dating an older man with 2 infants, born 2 months apart, to 2 other women. And to Mary Sue, this feels like the best she can hope for. Actually, the Mary Sue story is even worse. Mary Sue's older friend has told her he can get her a job working as a model in Toledo. The story gets even worse. Mary Sue recently posted on Facebook that she's figured out her problem. Her problem, she said, is that no one in the world loves her. And she's probably right about that. But she's figured out a solution to that problem. Mary Sue's going to have a baby, because at least the baby will love her. And if you think Mary Sue's in a pickle, what about Mary Sue's baby? These 2 young women, Miriam and Mary Sue, are almost exactly the same age. They're both granddaughters of Port Clinton, but they live in different universes. Rosemary and I are really proud of Miriam. Miriam has worked hard. She deserves the success she's going to have. But she made one really smart decision. She chose college-educated parents in a period in which well-off Americans, college-educated Americans, were doing pretty well. And Mary Sue's made only one really serious mistake in her life. She chose working-class parents in a period in which the American working class was not doing well. And from that randomness have flowed lives that are just completely inconceivable one to another. Miriam could not understand the future that awaits Mary Sue, and Mary Sue for sure couldn't understand the life that awaits our Miriam. Now, I want to tell you just a bit more about Port Clinton, because the story gets even more interesting in a way. Port Clinton, downtown, the main part of Port Clinton, looks like a basket case. You've seen pictures of this, like Rust Belt cities, the boarded up windows and broken windows and closed shops and so on. But Port Clinton has a lovely site on Lake Erie. When I was growing up, that was mostly fruit orchards and fishing camps. But now if you go there, along the shoreline of Port Clinton is essentially one long gated community, about 20 miles long and about 150 yards deep, of million-dollar mansions. Indeed, there's a road in Port Clinton. I'd love to take you and show it to you. You drive down this road called East Harbor Road, and if you look to the left toward the lake, the child poverty rate in that census tract is 0. There are no poor kids. That's all. They're million-dollar mansions. Of course, there are no poor kids living there at all. But just on the other side of the road, if you look at the dilapidated double-wides and the shacks, which is where Mary Sue lives, the child poverty rate is over 50%. This is a tiny little place. Now, if I told you there were big contrasts between rich areas and poor areas in New York City or, you know, Chicago or Los Angeles, you'd say, sure, got that, no problem. I got to understand that. I mean, maybe it's a problem, but I do understand it. But this is a tiny little town. This is a town like Peterborough. And that, it captures what's happening all over America. We've done very similar studies talking to rich kids and poor kids in Bend, Oregon, and in Orange County, California, and in Austin, Texas, and in Atlanta, and in a couple of suburbs of Boston, and in New Hampshire. And there are Mary Sues and Miriams everywhere in this country. We could all get in a bus right now. And within 5 minutes, we could find Miriams and Mary Sues from where we are right now. I want to read to you, we've done this study here in New Hampshire as well. I want to read to you just quickly an account of another kid. This is a kid, a young man, we're going to call him Pete. Pete's not his real name. He lives in a declining former mill town about an hour's drive from here. Pete's parents met in a bar, he thinks, but he saw his father only once when he dropped by for Pete's 8th birthday. Pete's mother has been in and out of work all her life and is now on disability. Pete says, "This is a real person I'm talking about." Pete says, "She's not good at dealing with stuff. I felt like giving up all the time." Pete and his mom live in severe poverty in a rough neighborhood. Not long ago, Pete stumbled into a drug-related shooting in his own driveway, and he once had to call 911 when he found his mom passed out with brown stuff coming out her nose, he said. This is a kid right here in New Hampshire. His desolate life has been lightened at times by flashes of mentorship. His ed teacher at school was nice to him, but despite severe problems in school caused by undiagnosed partial deafness, Pete, through hard work, graduated from high school. Currently, Pete is supporting his mom by working 2 part-time retail jobs, walking, because they don't have a car, walking 30 minutes each way to and from the mall year-round. Pete would like to attend community college, but he's reluctant because he's heard that it will simply load him up with loans that he won't be able to repay. Actually, I've talked with the head of community colleges in New Hampshire. That's not true. Pete could get a free ride, but Pete is alone. There's no loving adult in his life. No one in his life has the savvy to help Pete plan a realistic future. He'd like to, as he says, go for it, but he's loathe the risk, the little stability that he has been able, through his own efforts, to bring into his turbulent life. These are real kids, and they are all over America, this gap. But now at this point you're saying, come on, Putnam, you know, enough with the sob stories, please, and especially cherry-picking your own hometown, how's that? So I'm now going to reveal that I actually am really a counter and not just a storyteller. And so I'm going to summarize for you very quickly what the national data show, nationwide data show, a series of what we call scissors graphs. They look like this. I'm splaying my 2 fingers apart so that you can see that by many measures of the opportunities and resources and future open to kids coming from affluent homes, things are getting better and better and better. For kids like my Miriam, our Miriam, all by all these measures, things are getting better and better. But at the same time, among kids from the other side of the tracks, on those same measures, things are getting worse and worse. And that shows this, what we call yawning scissors graph, growing scissors graph. And that summarizes to a growing gap in the opportunities and really the future of kids coming from this side of town, the affluent side of town, and kids coming from the impoverished side of town. So now let me just go over for you quickly some of the kinds of measures that show this divergence. It's not just that kids from the affluent side of town are better off. They're getting more and more well off compared to poor kids. So it's true with respect to the money that parents can invest in kids, what we call summer camp gap. It's measured in the amount of money that parents spend per child per year. Used to be that people from this side of town, the affluent side of town, maybe spent a little more on each kid than the kids from the working class side of town. But now, on average, after enormous growth in the amount that the affluent parents are spending on their kids, per kid across America, every kid is getting $7,000, a little more than $7,000 a year in terms of summer camp and piano lessons and hockey skates and so on, computer games and trips to Paris. And there's been no growth at all on this side of town. So on these kids over here are now getting, on average, about $700 a year. So think much less likely that they're going to have trips to, you know, Boston, much less to Paris, and less summer camp, and fewer piano lessons, and so on. So a big gap in summer camp time, and a big gap, you understand, I'm just using summer camp as an illustration of this, but an even bigger gap in terms of the amount of time parents spend with kids. And we, what I mean by this, we're looking exactly at measures of how much time parents spend with their kids, not just changing diapers, but reading to them and playing patty cake with them and interacting with the kids. Used to be that there was no class difference in America. Kids from the affluent side of town and kids from the working class side of town basically got the same amount of time with mom and dad reading or playing whatever. But there's been a huge growth in this gap. So now the Miriams of America, that's my granddaughter, are getting 45 minutes a day more what we call goodnight moon time. 45 minutes a day more than the Mary Sue's of America. And if you think that 45 minutes a day is trivial, it's because you don't know what we've learned most recently about brain development. What we've learned is that the human brain is biologically programmed from birth. Our brain is programmed to learn from social interaction. It's what the pediatric neurologists call serve and response, like in a ping pong game, right? So the baby issues some signal, like goo-goo, and some nearby adult says, aw. And then the baby says, goo-goo, goo-goo, and the nearby adult says, aw, looks just like your mother. Do you see what I mean by this verbal ping pong? And our Miriam was getting tons of that goodnight moon time. Her parents read to her, Rosemary read to her, occasionally even I read to her, and Mary Sue, locked behind the baby gate, wasn't. And that's not just those two kids. What the data show is kids over here are now getting 45 minutes a day more of that brain stimulation. And that's why, now I'm moving to another measure, test scores show a growing gap between rich and poor. Test scores, you know, math and reading scores and so on, have been rising actually for kids from the affluent side of town and not for kids from the poor side of town, no matter how many resources, because those kids are coming to school with this deficit in place. The gap between the achievement gap between rich kids and poor kids in America is fully open before they get to school. And a large part of that is this home life that I'm describing. There are similar test score gaps in family dinners. By family dinners, I don't mean Thanksgiving. I mean sitting down with your kids and saying, how was your day? And these kids are increasingly getting that kind of stimulation from their parents, and these kids aren't. The similar kind of test, growing gap in the amount of extracurriculars that these kids take part. There's a gap, looks just like this. Kids from the upper middle class are playing sports and band and chorus and football and, debate and so on, as much as they ever did. But there's been, over the last 20 years, a sharp drop in working class kids taking part in those activities. And we know, actually, that the data show taking part in extracurricular activities does strengthen soft skills. That is, teamwork and what my mom used to call stick-to-itiveness, grit, and character. That's what kids learn in extracurricular activities. We know that for a fact, and we know that employers will, in fact, pay more to people who have those skills. So holding constant all the other things, your test scores and where you went to school and so on, taking part in extracurricular activities predicts a higher lifetime income. And you might want to know, well, why, if that's so important, why did suddenly, 20 years ago, kids stop taking part? And working class kids stop taking part in extracurricular activities. I don't know how many of you know the answer. Maybe you'll guess the answer. The answer is pay to play. Beginning 15 or 20 years ago, school boards, under pressure from us, decided to stop paying for band and chorus and football. In Port Clinton today, if you want to take part in extracurricular activities, per child, for one activity per year, is $800. So you got two kids in school, that's $1,600. If if your annual income is $200,000, as it is over on the affluent side of town, $1,600 is chicken feed. But if your annual income, as it is over here, is only $16,000, who in their right mind is going to pay 10% of their total annual family income, on football or trombone? And yet we know that those things matter. I think this actually, I sometimes get carried away, but I think this is evil, because for some of these growing gaps, we don't know what caused it. But this one, we do know what caused it. We did. And I have to say to the folks in the room here from Peterborough, to their great credit, the local school superintendent here has abolished pay-to-play in Peterborough for the local high school. And that's really good, but that's just a fraction of what we need to do. So there are growing gaps like that in going to church and taking part in community organizations and scouts and so on. Here's the bottom line. these kids from this side of town, not just homeless kids, but kids from working class homes, are increasingly in America isolated from everybody. They can't trust their parents because they're increasingly living in fragile and fractured families. They can't trust their neighbors because they're increasingly concentrated in dangerous, poor neighborhoods, just as this was true in Pete's case. They can't trust their coaches because they're no longer playing sports. They can't trust their clergy because they're no longer at church. They can't trust their scouts because they're no longer in scouts. They can't trust anybody, and they know that. And they are, if I can use a technical term, they are pissed. They are really distrustful and unhappy. Mary Sue recently posted on Facebook, "Love hurts. Trust kills." Think what it means to grow up in a society in which you can't trust anybody else. I mean, here's the answer. I want to convey what this is like just in the lives of these kids. So all kids do dumb things. Rich kids, poor kids, black kids, brown kids, white kids, even kids in Peterborough occasionally do dumb things. When a kid from the affluent side of town does a dumb thing, they get involved with drugs, or they drink too much, or they get in a fight with the teacher, or they back the car into the next door neighbor's, mailbox or whatever, instantly airbags inflate to protect the child from the worst consequences of that dumb decision. And if Miriam was involved, God forbid, we learn she's involved with drugs, the first thing I'd do is find the best lawyer in town, and the second thing I'd do is find the best rehab facility in town. And I don't apologize for that. That's what parents and loving grandparents do. But when Mary Sue did exactly the same dumb thing, no airbags, no learning experience, just an altered life. So the absence of adults, caring, loving, stable adults in the lives of these poor kids, not only in their own families, but from the rest of the community, is altering their future and making it less likely that kids from this side of the tracks, even if they're talented, will grow up to have a successful life. The odds that a kid from this side of town who has high test scores will graduate from college is lower than the odds that kids from this affluent side of town with low test scores will graduate from college. In short, smart, poor kids are less likely to graduate from college than dumb, rich kids. And that's fundamentally wrong. I'm not worried about if the parents of these kids want to pay for them to go to college, that's fine with me. But I am very deeply worried about all these smart kids over here who are not going to go to college, not because they couldn't hack it, but because they chose the wrong parents. And don't think that it's mostly about the tuition bills. It isn't. The basic fact is that the gaps have grown since these kids were really little, trying to understand the final outcome in terms of what just happened in college tuition is like trying to understand the Boston Marathon by looking only at a tape of the last 150 yards. Most of the damage, or most of the hurdles you have to pass, happened 10 or 50 miles earlier, and that's true in this case. Okay, I want to now ask just two questions to close. First of all, what caused all this? Well, there are a lot of different causes, but the fundamental cause, and it's embodied in the title of my book, Our Kids, is that when I was growing up in Port Clinton and my parents talked about doing things for our kids, like our kids need a swimming pool, we got to build a swimming pool here for our kids, they weren't talking about my sister and me by using the term our kids, they meant all the kids in town. And they were talking about everybody pitching in to have a pool at the high school. But now, if you listen carefully, when people talk about our kids, they mean their own biological kids. And if you talk to people in Port Clinton about Mary Sue, they say, sad story, not my kid, not my problem. And that is a fundamental change. Because these really are all of our kids. Our economic future depends upon these kids. Our economy is going to be poorer if we don't worry about these kids. Our politics are going to be, we've had an example of that this year. Our politics are going to be really pretty bad if we don't worry about these kids over here. But I'm optimistic, and now I want to just conclude by saying why I'm optimistic. We can fix this problem because we have before. America has been in this situation, exactly this situation, before in our history. Best example is 100, 120 years ago, the so-called Gilded Age, 1890, 1900, big gap between rich and poor, big social separation, high rates of immigration, high rates of political corruption, high rates of political alienation, because people at that time felt the political parties weren't helping us solve our problems. Any of that sound familiar? And then in a very short period of time, 10 years or so, Americans recognized the problem, began, folks over here on the affluent side of America began to recognize the problems down there and began to address them and to turn the country around. Many different examples. I just want to use one example of what we did then to close the opportunity gap. Americans in 1910, to narrow the opportunity gap in America then, invented the high school. The public high school was not invented by God, or if so, this is how we did it. In small towns across America, people said, we ought to have, all the kids in town ought to have 4 free years of comprehensive secondary education. Never been tried in the world before. Really an invention. And it was not an easy sell, because you had to convince the local rich bankers and lawyers and rich farmers who had already paid for their kids to go off to a private secondary school, and their kids were off now in Boston or Chicago or New York making money. You had to convince them they should pay for other people's kids to get a secondary education. And it was a hard sell, but in the beginning, in these small towns, people were able to make that leap, to think of those other kids as our kids too. And it turned out to be, in retrospect, the best public policy decision America has ever made. Why? Because that one decision, free universal secondary education for all kids, first of all, so raised the overall growth rate of the United States that that one decision accounts for most of America's economic growth in the entire 20th century. So everybody was better off. The bankers and the farmers and their kids, they were all better off. And at the same time, it leveled the playing field. So it did what economists tell us you can't do. It combined making progress on equity and making progress on productivity at the same time. Now, the crucial thing to ask is, how did that happen? That solution and the other solutions of that period did not come from Harvard. And they did not come from Washington. They came from small towns and cities, just like this one, all across America. Now, if we've done it once, we could do it again. I'm not saying that the high school is this century's solution. That was last century's solution. I'm trying to say, and exactly what the 21st century equivalent of the high school is, I'm not sure. I put together, with the help of many colleagues across the country, this report, which is called Closing the Opportunity Gap. You can find it at theopportunitygap.com, which brings together a lot of suggestions that could be tried out. It's a list of, you know, have you thought about this? But I also need to tell you that right here in New Hampshire, there is a group, indeed right here in the Monadnock region, there is a group of local folks, local leaders here and across this state, under the leadership of the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. It's an initiative called New Hampshire Tomorrow, which is meeting in small groups and investing money to try to help poor kids from our state and from our communities. So this is something that we can do. We can begin to close this gap and put America back on a better track toward equality for all of our kids. It's people in rooms just like this across the state that will make that happen. So I'm counting on you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Putnam.